I am not a number. I am a free man. Or, you know, at least a podcaster, which is kind of the same thing.
Pays the same.
Welcome back to Agents of Cool, where today we begin our study of the classic cult 1960s spy-fi show, The Prisoner. Now, here's how we usually do these things. Normally, we'll pick an episode of a 60s show, and we'll give you a little backstory on it, and where the who created it, and what years did it run, stuff like that. I think this show, it's not exactly serialized, but it has an extraordinary heft of intellectual ambition.
It has a beginning and it has an end.
It has a beginning, a middle, the middle is like the show.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, you could probably shuffle the various episodes between the beginning and the end around, and there isn't really a lot of connectivity between them, unless it was a two-parter.
Technically, the finale is a two-parter.
Yeah, so other than like the end two and the first one, you could show them in just about any order, and it would not be any more or less comprehensible.
Flash forward, spoiler, actually you can't spoil it. The last episode is the most bug nuts thing I have ever seen broadcast.
We could tell you, we could do a blow by blow reenactment for it on the podcast and you would still watch it. And again, it wouldn't spoil anything, but you'd still be completely bamboozled by what you saw on the screen.
Now I'm actually tempted to do a video podcast and reenact that last episode with hand puppets. Like, we could get a little sock puppet, and this will be the little Patrick McGoohan sock puppet, and this will be the little Leo McKern sock puppet. Now I'm actually tempted to do
and
that.
And we just get, like, a little white balloon and go, womp, womp, womp.
Yes! Yes, exactly. Exactly. I am, like Potter Puppet Pals. It'd be Prisoner Puppet Pals. I gotta write that down. That's too good to lose.
Prisoner
when
Puppet Pals.
When your daughter
pals.
Gets a hold of this, I'm not responsible for what
prisoner
happens.
Prisoner Puppet Pals.
Oh my lord.
Oh my god, that's going to be so much fun.
That we've created a monster.
So the bottom line here again is, we've been doing this show for 2-3 years now, and we've been kind of putting Prisoner off and putting it off and putting it off, and I think at this point, we've got enough episodes under our belt, enough experience, that our goal here is to do this show an episode at a time. If you watched an episode from Third Year Man from Uncle, First Year Man from Uncle, you may notice that one of them is in color, and one of them is in black and white, one of them might be a little campier, and one of them might be a little more serious, but The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and this is not meant disrespectfully at all, does not have the same heft of intellectual ambition that The Prisoner's got. Man from U.N.C.L.E. just wants to entertain you for an hour. McGoohan and the staff and the writers of The Prisoner want to entertain you, and they want to make you think, and they want to prod you and piss you off and make you angry.
I'm not sure, actually. I mean, from what I've read, if you were entertained, McGoohan was fine with that. If you weren't entertained, McGoohan was also fine with that. Your entertainment was really not McGoohan's problem.
Not his problem. We do need to address for a moment our relative levels of exposure to the world of The Prisoner. I first watched The Prisoner in the 90s with a mutual college friend of my co-hosts. We watched them. I don't think we watched them in order. We watched some of them. Everybody say hi, Susan.
Hi, Susan.
So I watched them all with her back in the 90s, and then got the DVDs myself later, watched them in sequence. So I've seen them with someone of significance to us, your humble podcasters, and I've seen them on my own. Love the show. There is just something so, I don't know, it's not rebellious, exactly defiant. That's the word. There's something so defiant about the character of Six in the face of everything they throw against him. He will not bend, he will not break. And there are some things in a world that expects you to bend and break on a daily basis. I kind of like that. Right.
So for me, and this was back, I would have been in high school, would have been maybe my 9th or 10th grade year. And I can't remember whether it was just flipping through the TV guide, or it had, you know, it was just coming on, they were airing it on the PBS station, the local PBS channel in there. And I just said, oh, you should take a look at that. And what's it about? It's like, yeah, just watch it. You know, because I'm like, I have no idea what this is. And I watched it. It may have been the first episode. And I was completely just, I was floored. Now, you know, I was a fan of, you know, some, you know, British shows. I think you know, Doctor Who, watching, staying up, you know, till 1 in the morning to watch Doctor Who, and then occasionally, oh, it's fundraising drive, you know, please donate or we'll burn the tape right in front of you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But this was just like, you know, it was just like, what is this, you know, I mean, the music, Patrick McGoohan, because I hadn't seen Secret Agent or anything. I just, and just, you know, Patrick McGoohan's, you know, delivery, the acting, the whole thing was just, it just blew me away. And I was just like, you know, okay, what's the secret? Why did he resign? What's the, you know, which is, you know, spoilers, not entirely relevant to what The Prisoner is all about, but I didn't know that at, you know, 9th, 10th grade. But it just, yeah, I had never seen anything like it before or since. And you go all the way through to Blow Up, and I'm just, you know, again, I must have watched that 3 or 4 times. I figured, what the heck is going on? And I'm, you know, still to this day, you can watch it and get a different takeaway from what's going on there. But yeah, that just absolutely, I mean, you know, that just kind of, you know, I don't know why my dad said, oh, you still, okay, I know why my dad says you totally watch it, because he liked the show when it initially aired, but he didn't want to spoil anything. To the extent you can spoil anything. You just, you know, because you go into that, if you don't know anything about The Prisoner and you're listening to this podcast, go find The Prisoner, watch it, just hit stop, watch it, come back. Because it, I mean, audiences have been the 60s when they first saw it. They didn't have, you know, the internet and Buzz and Starlog and all that stuff to tell them what it was going to be about. They just turned on the TV and went, what the heck is this? And we get to the last episode, they went, what the heck is this? And they called the TV stations wanting to know, what the heck was that? But yeah, because that, you know, this is all, yeah, so that was just, yeah, that was my first exposure. And then, you know, there's some of a paucity of materials on the ground. Weirdly enough, probably the best prisoner, you know, best prisoner book I found for the longest time was the GURPS Prisoner Source Book.
Generic Universal Role-Playing System.
So yes, it is a role-playing game supplement for The Prisoner, for GURPS, which translates into, I think, somebody really liked The Prisoner, and I'm guessing somebody at Steve's Asking Games really likes The Prisoner. So,
yeah.
But there, yeah, there's a, that's, I mean, if you can find a copy of it, because I don't think it's still in print, it might be on their web store, I haven't gone checking, I have one print copy, it's mine, no one can have it. There's all sorts of little bits and pieces about the symbolism and such in there. That's just, it's a great read. But you know, of course, you know, you can type in The Prisoner in Wikipedia and you get everything. So it's kind of, anyway.
Stacey.
Yeah. So I'm kind of the experimental guinea pig here because I have not actually seen most of
I'm gonna poke her with a pen.
Poke. Now, through I'm not poke. Completely innocent. Through general cultural osmosis, I
oh,
know
boy,
what
the you're not completely innocent.
Thank you. I know what The Prisoner is, the basic concept. I've even seen the infamous last episode because I wanted to know what that was all about, and it doesn't make any more sense without any context than it does with context, apparently. So it doesn't matter.
No, it makes sense, but yeah, there's some there. It helps to have watched the first episode, you know, the setup. It helps
that's
to have seen
fair.
Some of the other stuff. It is kind of a capstone mm-hmm. to everything. So if you just watched, I think, like, the first episode and the last one, you can get the general gist, but you're missing out.
Right, yeah. What I really am in this adventure to know is, what is the general run of The Prisoner like? What is an episode like? How does it keep you from wanting to kill yourself every single episode because this guy doesn't actually achieve his goal of getting out of this place.
But he doesn't break.
But he also doesn't break, as you say, yes.
This show doesn't tell you what to think about it. This show doesn't tell you what opinion to have. This show doesn't tell you what side McGowan's on. It doesn't tell you what side the Masters of the Village are on. It doesn't tell you what any of the secrets are. This show goes out of its way to thwart what you think a spy show should be and instead be its own kind of thing. So you're gonna watch it. You're going to bring your own thing to it. If you watch it, we're watching it in the year of our Lord 2020. Maybe you find this podcast 5 years from now or 10 years from now or 20 years from now, and you're going to find it in your space and your time and your whatever the
after
world is like.
After the fall of civilization.
After the fall of man. Although, if you're listening to us after the fall of man,
if we are all that remains of human culture, we are so sorry.
Well, speak for yourself. If we're all that remains of human culture, I think we're making a pretty good showing for ourselves here. But, I mean, you're going to bring whatever, and I first saw it back in the night. We first saw it in our different days and our times, and if this is, you're discovering it for the first time, or if you saw it on TV back in the 60s. You bring your own experience to it. And it's you're really never going to see anything else like it because it's hugely influential. I know, I mean, hell, you could point at Lost a little bit and see a little bit of The Prisoner in that. You could point at Oddly enough, there's actually a two-parter of the classic G.I. Joe animated series. It's strongly influenced by The Prisoner.
Oh yeah.
You find the influences and echoes of The Prisoner all throughout television, all throughout film. You see it in comics. It's something genuinely special that they did for TV. They did one season. There's never been anything else like it. And we are going to try to dig in here episode by episode and wrestle with the show. We're not here to tell you what it means. We're not here to tell you what to think about it. We're not here to, that's up to you. What it means, what you think about it, what it's about. The show doesn't tell you. We're not going to tell you. Well, except we are going to tell you. We're going to tell you a little bit.
Right. I mean, if we're just going to say, this is what happened in the episode, thank you, good night. Well, why don't
you can just watch the episode.
You could just do that yourself. So yeah. We're going to tell you what we, well, let me rephrase that. We're going to tell you what we think, but we're not going to tell you what to think. We open episode one. Storm clouds, the rumble of thunder. We see a flat landscape of the road on it. Coming at you on that landscape, a car blazing down the highway. A really cool tiny car.
It's a little two-seat Caterham sports car. You know, it's not.
The driver has great hair, blazing determination in his eyes. He enters London.
Let's see the music. We're not going to repeat the music, partly because, you know, we don't have the rights. But go look it up on YouTube. Go look up the intro, if nothing else. The music.
Yeah, if nothing else, look the intro up on YouTube.
Talk about spy music. Okay, you know, the James Bond theme or whatever. But the other gold standard, as far as I'm concerned, 60 spy music is
the theme of The Prisoner. So the car enters London, parks in a car park. The driver gets out. He stalks down a long, dark corridor. Like the intermittent lights in the ceiling, he walks in and out of pools of light and shadow. He slams open the doors of an office. The office has what we think is some kind of spy chief behind a desk. There's a map of the world on the wall behind him. The driver comes in, slams his fist on the table, stalks around, yells at his boss, slams an envelope down the table.
All to the sound of thunder. We have no idea what he's angry about, but he's obviously agitated and is, you know, yeah.
He's angry. He walks in. He slams his fist down on the table, the desk, so hard he shatters a teacup. He didn't touch it. He didn't punch the teacup. He just punched the desk, and the teacup shatters. He stalks out of the office.
He tosses down an envelope.
Basically. Tosses down an envelope. Do we know the contents of the envelope?
It says, resignation, delivered by hand.
Delivered by hand. We cut to a photograph of the driver. It's in a typewriter. X's are being typed over the picture of the driver. A machine takes the picture, drops it into a file cabinet. The file cabinet closes. It's labeled resigned. The driver drives to his house. He enters his house. He goes in, still with the music, still with the thunder. He goes in. He's packing a bag. He's pissed. He's moving as fast as he can. He's got to get out of town. A hearse pulls up in front of his house. Someone dressed as an undertaker steps out of the hearse, walks up to his front door.
Now, you've seen this hearse, or different hearses, you know, in multiple shots as he goes there. And initially, you know, one, as he pulls out of the parking lot, you see the front of one just pull into frame very close, you know, close to the viewer as he zips by. And the implication, there's a reverse shot that the implication, the way it's framed, isn't that we're just using this as a camera truck. It's there is a camera on that vehicle that is watching him.
Mm-hmm. Is the driver being followed by death? I don't know. So the undertaker steps up to his house. Suddenly, inside the house, while the driver is packing, he puts a picture of a tropical island on top of his clothes in his suitcase, closes the suitcase. Suddenly, gas enters the house. He starts feeling woozy. He passes out, eyes closed, falls over, bam, wakes up. He's in a cottage, perfectly lovely cottage, but where is he? He doesn't know. He gets up. He opens the door of the cottage. He looks out. He's in a quaint seaside village. It's perfectly lovely. There's nothing wrong with it. He gets out, he starts exploring, slightly frantic. Where am I? What's going on? It's morning. The people of the village are opening their restaurants, hosing down sidewalks, putting chairs out for a day of business. He harasses a lady at the cafe, doesn't he? Where am I? What's going on? He calls a taxi. The taxi shows up almost instantly. That drives him around for a minute. He goes to the general store.
Doesn't leave town because it's only the local service.
It's only the local service. He wants to leave. The taxi won't take him. He can't take him. It's only the local service. He goes in. There's a general store. There's a perfectly lovely plump guy with a straw hat there. I'd like to buy a map.
Well, no, he goes in there. The store clerk is speaking a completely different language to, foreign language to the customer. And then when they catch Patrick McGowan's character, starts talking to her in English.
Yeah.
No explanation is given for this.
He tries to buy a map. Here's a color, a black and white. Doesn't matter. Gives him the black and white map. He opens it up. Everything's labeled generically. Hmm. Mountains, general store, council building, street.
It is a map of your village.
Map of your, the label says map of your village. There aren't any details. It's all simple. The village he's in is surrounded by mountains. No immediate, obvious way out. And they are merely labeled
the mountains.
The mountains. So a map with a little Indiana Jones deal there. The map with no names. Map with no names. He
asks for a larger map. That's only available in color. I don't care. He gets the map. The larger map is a larger map.
Of the village.
In color. The exact same map.
So, maps of the area. No demand for them, sir.
No demand for them, sir. The driver stalks out of the general store.
Be seeing you.
Be seeing you. Stalks out of the... returns to his cottage. Still pissed. Still kind of bug-eyed, angry. The phone rings. He picks hers up. He answers it. It's an invitation to breakfast with number two. Number two is in the building with the green dome.
Mm-hmm. He lives in number six.
He lives in number six.
No. Throughout this, okay, so it's a peaceful, little village, right?
It's a perfectly lovely village. Why wouldn't you want to live there?
But, it's little weird things like, the driver talks to him, the taxi driver talks to him in English and then tries French when he sort of stares at her somewhat incomprehendingly. Mm-hmm. And when he asks, why do you guys in French? Well, it's the international language. We get all kinds of languages around here or something to that effect. When
it's very cosmopolitan. It's very cosmopolitan.
She says, be seeing you, and does this little sort of okay symbol from her eye. The shopkeeper does it. Mm-hmm. Everybody
does it.
So it's gradually, it looks like a perfectly weird, perfectly peaceful seaside village.
At least the people who seem to work for the village wear this little pin.
With a number, yeah.
A number and a penny farthing bicycle.
Right. So, but all these little details start accruing. The first little be seeing you thing, okay, that's weird. When it becomes clear this is the standard, this is what they say instead of goodbye. It starts. It's all these little weird sub details. The doors, to his little apartment opens automatically. I don't think anybody opens a door in this episode.
That's a really good sound effect, by the way.
It's very weird. A couple times the door opens. He's going to leave, and he's told, you might as well go ahead and he says at one point about I'm going to go take a walk. And before he turns to the door goes and opens. Now, apparently they're getting the same doors that you get from, the Next Generation where they have a plot sensor, but it's all those little things that, that was not an oversight. That was deliberate. It's all these little small details that it just goes from, okay, it's a regular, seaside village. And then you start looking all these little these little details out of the corner of your eye effectively that, this is not what it seems, and there's something a lot more sinister going on here.
So, the driver, who still doesn't have a name. Mm-hmm. He hasn't been given a name yet. We don't know who he is. The driver goes down to the building with the green dome. He's ushered in by a short, charming little butler. He's ushered into a control room, like a super mod 60s control room. The rotating magic 8-ball chair turns around, and he's faced with a genial fellow in a scarf. It's not Tom Baker, in case you were wondering. But the man identifies himself as number two. Wonders if maybe the driver would not mind a working breakfast. So the butler wheels in breakfast. The butler wheels in breakfast. And number two says, what kind of tea would you like? Indian or Chinese? Doesn't matter. Lemon? And then as soon as he says, yes, I would like lemon tea, there's already a lemon in his tea. How many eggs would you like? One or two? Six says two. He lifts the lid on the tray. There's already two eggs.
The there's this little butler guy. This is the only other recurring character besides Patrick McGowan's.
No, wait. The bald guy in the control room.
Oh, yeah.
Guy that looks like looks a little bit like that guy from Stargate, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Weirdly. Someone that do they shut down the village? Does he get a job with the Stargate program? I don't know. There's some fan fiction there. But So this is the part where we're starting to get some glimmer of what's actually going on. It seems that our driver has resigned from some unspecified service. It seems that there's a lot of secrets packed in his head. It seems that makes him a valuable commodity. It seems that he gave a reason for his resignation, but there are forces afoot in the world that want to know exactly why he resigned, that want to know the truth.
Or at least that's what number two tells him.
Or at least that's what number two tells him, because one of the things you're going to learn with this show is to take nothing ever at face value. So why am I here? Why did you resign? And we find out that they've actually got a very thick file on him. They've got pictures of him from what he thought were simple, inconsequential days of his life. They have his baby pictures. They have all of his personal information. They have been watching him. They know everything about him except why he resigned.
They have pictures where basically, you know, he was supposed to meet a contact named Cobb and they didn't turn up. And here's he went back to his hotel room and tried to figure out what was going on. And I mean, so it's like they have everything. Other than apparently the time he, you know, the time
he was born,
which was in for them, and
which was something like 4 a.m. on March 19th, 1928. The driver insists that he will say nothing. Do the thing. Filed, debriefed. I will not be filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered.
My life is
my own.
He very clearly, you know, resents being there, being taken there, and you know it's.
Number two insists it's only a matter of time. You will talk. You will tell us what you want to know. I'm not convinced he's ever going to tell them what they want to know, but we're going to watch the show and find out, right? So after this confrontation in the control room, number two takes him on a helicopter tour. And there's a rule here about Chekhov's helicopter. If you see the helicopter earlier in the show, you got to use it later, right?
Right, because they're fantastically expensive.
They're very expensive. So you're not going to use a helicopter just for one scene. So number two takes him on a helicopter tour of their little village. And it's a wonderful little seaside town. It kind of reminds me of a place called Port Myron in Wales. But it's a wonderful little seaside town. And he takes him on a tour. Here's our council building. We've got a graveyard. We've got our own little world here. Sometimes we put on amateur theatricals. And that makes me think of The Next Generation, where, you know, apparently one of the busiest ships in the fleet has time to put on a production of King Lear once a month or something like that. But whatever. It's a wonderful place to look at. Helicopter lands next to the old people's home. How do you know it's the old people's home? Because it's clearly labeled as such. Wonderful little font, clear, well-designed, old people's home. At the old people's home, he's briefly introduced to a chess player named the Admiral. From the old people's home, they get a taxi. They take a taxi into town. And number two goes on about how all these people get along here just fine. All these people get along here just fine. And six says, is it up to them? And number two says, they've made a choice. You give us what you want, you'll be well taken care of. All the way up to the old people's home if you want to. Give us what you want and everything will be fine. But apparently there's somebody in that crowd not with the program. At a word from number two, everyone in the town freezes. They all stop, except one man in sunglasses who looks a little sketchy. And then, I'm not 100% sure where it came from, but suddenly, and this isn't actually mentioned.
The implication it comes from, there's a water fountain, and it stops. I think the implication is it comes out of the water fountain.
Okay, that's good. I like that. Emerges from the water fountain, a white moving globe about 6 feet across. Now, it doesn't name it in the show, so we're going to break the timeline here a little bit. It's called a rover. It's a rover unit. It's got this weird, unsettling sound effect, and it chases, while everyone else in the village is standing stock still, chases this, even the water fountain itself is frozen, chases this guy through the village, and then apparently absorbs him somehow?
Suffocates him or something? It's not clear if he, you know, kills him.
But there doesn't seem to be a body left when it bounces away.
Yeah. So it's generally kind of effed up. It's really weird. Now, I also know from our friend Susan back in the day that it's really just a weather balloon and they had to figure out some way to do this on a budget. And one of the things she pointed out then, and I'll point out to you now, is they took a budgetary limitation and made it one of the freakiest things I've ever seen on television.
Rover by itself doesn't seem all that threatening. They give a sound to it, like a roar that makes it really scary.
I can't even do it. No, that's weird. Right? I shouldn't have done that. That's bad.
But I have to admit, well, the being suffocated by the plastic is pretty bad. The just sort of being vaguely pummeled by an animate weather balloon is not. It's kind of silly to watch, but I presume it would still be unpleasant to experience.
But the sound effect with it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know.
But as just sort of a a guard dog, it's very effective.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's kind. I mean, it's kind of creepy. And again, they set it up. It the guy that's on, that runs from it is clearly scared to death of it, and
as well he should be.
Yeah, and so I mean, that's basically the yeah. I mean, the fact that they never explain what it is adds to the creepy factor a little bit.
Yeah.
They don't. I mean, nobody comments on it. Nobody, you know, the prisoner isn't, you know, isn't just utterly agape at it. We haven't seen anything, you know, super crazy gadgety or, you know, anything like you're used to from spy movies or, you know, the spy-fi space. But here's this weird, creepy thing, and it's like, what is it? How does it work? What is this even? And it's never explained. And that, you know, so what can it do? What can't it do? You don't know.
And it's freaky. So after this incident, number two takes the driver to a place he calls the Labor Exchange.
I think we should probably call him the prisoner at this point, because there will be other people driving vehicles later.
Good point. It is the title. It's the title of the show, The Prisoner.
That's probably not too much of a spoiler. The show is called The Prisoner.
Programming note, the character referred to as the driver will now hereafter be referred to as the prisoner.
This will make it less confusing later when he, you know, there are other people driving cars who are not the prisoner.
Exactly.
He will probably get another name before the end of the episode.
Spoilers. Not really. So number two takes number six to the Labor Exchange, where I assume, given the name, this is where they, you know, sort out who does what job. And they've got the worst motivational posters I've ever seen on the walls. A still tongue is a happy life. And what else did they have? That was the big one. It's like there's not even a cat on any of them. Just the worst motivational posters you've ever seen.
There's one about questions and answers.
Questions are a burden to others. Answers are a burden to oneself.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So number two brings six to the Labor Exchange, and they walk him into a back room, which looks like it could have been a control room all by itself.
Right. It was, again, it has the exact same, you know, big giant metal automatic doors that the number two's little sanctum had.
So we go in, and there's a perfectly lovely sort of what would you call him, bureaucrat? Perfectly lovely, genial bureaucrat standing there. Hello, sir. We would like to give you an aptitude test, and his aptitude test apparently involves putting a round peg in a round hole. Which six can do. So that's good. That'll help his employability score.
Then there's a questionnaire that involves a Tinker Toys structure.
And it's a perfectly lovely Tinker Toys. Because you know the guy has just spent hours putting this together. And he says, we have a questionnaire for you to answer. Do you have questions about, you know, family, your life in general, religion, politics? And as soon as the guy says politics, the prisoner gets really pissed off and like says, fuck your Tinker Toys, and smashes them all to the floor, right? So yeah, it was like really kind of aggro. So they leave he leaves the Labor Exchange and stalks back to his cottage. There's a young maid in there, a pretty young blonde girl, and where if this had been Sean or Roger or any of those guys, we'd be, you know, wah, 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 wah. But instead he just kind of barks at her. What are you doing in my house? Get out of here! And she goes, blah, and she leaves, right? Well, okay, maybe she doesn't go, blah. But anyway, so he starts, you know, sort of stalking angrily around his cottage. It's a perfectly lovely cottage. There's no reason you wouldn't want to live there. It has every amenity. It turns out it already had a map in the desk.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't need to spend the money on the map. There's a map in the desk. It's perfectly lovely. It's livable. It's spacious. It's nice. It's clean. There's music being piped in. And he grabs the radio off the shelf, smashes it to the floor, and the music goes on. In the meantime, there's actually an announcement that the electrics people should be going to cottage number six because there's been an interruption with the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So they're watching him every minute of every day. So anyway, the maid comes back.
She forgot something.
He barks at her some more. And then he gets like a really judgmental all up in her grill. Didn't you ever wonder why you were here? Does anyone ever try to escape? Didn't you ever wonder who runs this place? And she gets all like, she turns on the waterworks a little bit. She starts crying some. It's like, oh my God, they told me if I could get just a little information from you, they would help me. And he's like, you know, get out, all cold and stuff. Seriously, McGowan is like, Connery is like a ripe bastard, but he's not ice cold. The prisoner is ice cold.
Your services will not be required tomorrow.
So
she departs. We cut to the control room, number two, and the supervisor, the little bald-haired gentleman
who looks like the guy from Stargate.
So they're like, oh, I really thought she was going to get something, you know, get it out of him. It was a setup from the
beginning.
I mean, that was kind of clear.
No, but the entire
Right.
All of, you know, I think the implication is the waterworks, everything.
Oh, definitely. Was entirely
from beginning to end.
Oh, yeah.
It was entirely a performance.
Oh, yeah.
So, and then the guys say, well, he's dangerous. Mm-hmm. This man's dangerous. We got to be gentle with him because what he knows is too important, right? Mm-hmm. The implication being that we're not going to the electrodes to his nuts yet. We're not going to cut his skull open yet.
Right.
Right. I think there's a line somewhere in there when one of the number twos is recording a report that, you know, due to the value of the subject, you know, we're not going to try extreme measures just yet.
Just yet. Although it's clearly still on the table. Mm-hmm. So back at cottage number.
Oh boy.
So apparently just living in this place usually causes most people to crack.
Now, I admit what.
And I guess the fact that everyone who might possibly approach you and act sympathetic is probably working for the people who run the place.
Okay, so I mean, the thing is, like, just the playing,
right.
I mean, at a certain point, I was really hoping, you know, realized that like this music is really annoying. Therefore, I realized, oh, this isn't background music. This is actually
it's supposed
in camera.
To be, yeah.
And then he finally said, "I'm like, oh, thank God, you're smashing that, and it doesn't stop." I'm right there with him because I wanted the, the elevator music to stop.
Stop.
Right.
And we were in there for all of what we were watching that for all of what. Right. 2-3 minutes.
The scene's maybe 3 minutes long.
5-6 hours every single day.
Right.
Well, what I think the show is about. Well, get to that with the end there.
Right. But
there's a running theme through here that I think you've got an idea of what the show is really about, and it's not about what it says on the tin. I don't think.
Well, there's right. There's the plot, and then there's what the show is about.
Right.
And those are kind of two different things here. Mission Impossible, what the show is about is the plot. Man from U.N.C.L.E., what the show is about is the plot. And that's all fine. We're not. But this show, what the show is about is not what the plot is. So,
yeah, unlike your more recent serialized mystery box kind of shows, the question of why he resigned or even what the village is not actually the important
right,
that's, thing to resolve at any point.
Yeah, and that was when I first started watching it, that was thinking like, you know, I was just, you know, looking for any little tidbit of what or why or what, you know, why he resigned, because I was thinking in terms of things like, you know, that kind of show. Mm-hmm. But that's not really, those are mystery boxes in the but they're not meant to be open. They're simply they are MacGuffins. Mm-hmm. They're MacGuins.
MacGuins. Like
they're
it.
MacGuins for the
brilliant. I love that. That's if we only ever add one thing to the human conversation, that's it. That's the one I want in the tombstone of this show.
The MacGuin.
The MacGuin. The thing everybody is after that we're not supposed to find. Mm-hmm. The MacGuin.
Well, the MacGuffin is also the same.
No. The MacGuffin is the thing everybody is after that nobody really cares about. Mm. But you're supposed to find it. The MacGuin is the thing everybody is after that it doesn't matter if you find or not, because it's not what the show's about. I am proud to know you, sir. That's brilliant. I love it.
Speaking of another weird show that might have taken some inspiration from this, apparently that was the point of Twin Peaks, according to David Lynch, but that's not how most of us watching it thought it was supposed to be. Like, the question of who killed Laura Palmer was not actually ever supposed to be answered.
And coincidentally,
it was just about the characters doing their thing.
And coincidentally, when they finally answered the question, the show went off a cliff.
Yeah.
That was the end.
Fundamentally unsatisfying. So the key thing is if the mystery box is going to be opened, you better have something good in it. I'm looking at you, Chris Carter and J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
To be fair, Fringe, they did a pretty good job on Fringe. They actually they had something in the boxes, and it was not what we were expecting, but it was.
And turns out Chief Palpatine was in one of those mystery boxes, but he put him in at the last minute. But we're not a Star Wars podcast. But so anyway, back at cottage number 6, the electrics guy shows up, starts fixing the thing. Number 6 says, "I think I'll take a walk." And it's like, this guy's just some poor workman here to fix the fucking radio. And 6 is like, "I'm going to take a walk." And the guy's like, "Suit yourself. Jesus, suit yourself. Go for a walk."
No, he says, "No, feel free."
Feel free. Not be free. Feel free. Not quite the same thing. Uh-huh. So anyway, 6 takes a walk, and is that the graveyard he's in with the heads on the statues, or is that a statue?
No, basically, so he takes a walk, decides basically see if he can maybe possibly slip out. Now he gets up on some sort of walking trail, and he runs into some sort of groundskeeper who looks exactly like
the electric guy. Yeah.
Oh.
So
that was supposed to look exactly like the electric guy. Okay.
Because it was the same actor. But the thing is, nobody there is what they seem. Everybody there is potentially compromised. Everybody there could be on the village payroll. That's the whole point.
You can't trust anybody. Nothing is face value in this place.
So, he basically tries to kind of slip out of view. And, of course, you know, they're watching him the whole time. And there's a, you know, there's a section, you know, these little Greek, you know, sort of Greek statue, you know, Greek statue busts and such.
Now,
and
I kind of interpret that to be some kind of graveyard. Like, these are the head sculpts of the guys that are buried there, or something like that.
I think those are just supposed to be sort of like little, you know, Roman busts of various, you know, emperors and
statuary display or something. Okay, just random statuary. Yeah, okay.
The graveyard, which we do see later, they mentioned that they had one. That is.
Well, that's the one on the beach. The one on the beach seemed pretty small for the whole village, the number of bodies they probably put through there. So I thought maybe I don't know. So anyway, their statuary, and it's like weird Roman busts of emperors and things.
And
they've all got cameras in their eyes.
Yeah, they rotate to follow him. He's kind of running, and then I think he finally.
Some of them have glowy eyes.
What is it? And they're I think, you know, the supervisor who's monitoring him is, you know, just saying, you know, he's heading to post 14, yellow alert, and, you know, it's up. Then he makes a run for the beach, and. Then they
intercept a little buggy. He intercepts a little buggy that's trying to intercept him.
And he overcomes the
drivers of that buggy. Mm-hmm. The prisoner, as distinct from the drivers, as in the footnote about 15 minutes ago, he's the prisoner. These are the drivers. He intercepts the buggy, beats the crap out of the drivers, and is intercepted by a rover on the beach.
Mm-hmm. And Patrick McGoohan basically gets into a fist fight with a weather balloon and loses.
But because the sound effect is so cool, you don't really. And he's a good actor; he sells it. But he's basically fist fighting a weather balloon on a beach.
The horrific death mask face pressed up against the balloon plastic,
which is kind of awful, really.
Yeah,
I mean, we were all told what happens if you put your head in a plastic bag as children. So.
So yeah, that's yeah. Yeah, so we all remember that.
It is generally, I mean, it's serviceable again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don't. And again, the fact that nobody tells you what the damn thing is or what it does is just a little
It's freaky. Creepy. So Six is retrieved by a bunch of guys in white coats. He wakes up in the hospital. Mm-hmm. He's greeted by a creepy old lady knitting. I finally woke up, did you? And then he sees someone he knows.
Cobb,
a man named Cobb. And we assume because... So far, this show has the surface of the details of a spy show. We assume he's some kind of fellow agent. Mm. Does the show ever tell us that, or is that just the assumption?
Mentioned in one of the past memories that they were surveilling?
Yeah, that was. They mentioned he was supposed to. You know, and that's the thing. He was supposed to meet Cobb for something, and Cobb didn't show up, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So this is Cobb.
Someone the prisoner knew, and here's Cobb, and he talks to Cobb briefly, and Cobb's like, where am I? What's going on? He's kind of spaced. He's spacey. He's out of it.
4 weeks, 4 days. He's not real sure.
He doesn't know how long he's been there. He doesn't know what's been done to him. They've been trying to get information out of him.
Right. I think his story kind of tracks with the last time the prisoner saw him, and he doesn't know if he's been there 4 days or 4 weeks, or, you know, he's kind of out of it. And then I think.
A medical doctor comes in, wants to continue the examination of the prisoner, and he gripes about it and does this thing, but the prisoner goes with him, and they see some like really freaky shit in the hallway, like a hallway full of
purple light, and then
purple light, and then like, people with masks sitting on the floor.
Basically, it's those little eye covers, and I think they're in straight jackets, and
that's the group therapy area.
That's the group therapy area, and then
they see a guy that's kind of. I don't know if he's got sort of electrodes on his head or whatever.
His head's been shaved and he has electrodes on it.
He's being led down the hallway.
Just kind of staring into the middle distance.
Yeah. The implication being that if one doesn't cooperate, this is a little hint of some of the extreme methods we might be looking at. So the doctor gives him an examination. He passes with flying colors.
The examination is weird because he looks at it a little bit. It has, you know, one of those big giant... lamps like you see in Quincy, which our younger viewers will need to look that up as well.
Yeah.
And then he punches some stuff into a keypad, and it's not numbers on a keypad. It's like weird little, you know, Greek letters or whatnot. And this computer tape bank spins and spits out a punch card and looks at it and gives him a clean bill of health.
Huh.
And, you know, mentioned something about, you know, the prisoner initially reluctant. The doctor's like, well, you know, there's some, you know, those after effects can be pretty nasty. I guess the assumption being grabbed by Rover is, I guess, the implication there. But yeah, so it just, and then he says you're fine, and then he's sent back to the
prisoner
ward.
Sent back to his ward, where he finds out that Cobb has jumped out a window to his death. Mm-hmm. So the next shot is the prisoner. He's been released. His old clothes have been burned. He's been issued new clothes, a straw boater hat that he disdains, and I don't know why, because it's a perfectly fine hat. So he throws the straw hat off into the backseat of the taxi. And that sort of
white-lined black jacket that other people are wearing.
Yeah.
The very distinctive village attire.
So he's given a, what is it, you know, here's your health insurance, here's your health services card, here's your work card, and your credit card, and they give him a little badge with a six on it.
Yeah.
So he shall henceforth, we started as the driver, then we started calling him the prisoner. And even though he insists he's not a number, we will hereafter be referring to him as number six.
Or the prisoner when we forget.
Or the prisoner, could go either way.
So he tosses the number, just tosses the number and the hat.
Tosses the number and the hat. He goes to confront number two and finds that it's a different guy altogether. This guy is not so genial. This guy is not so cooperative, not so persuasive. This guy is like, you're going to cooperate with us or we're going to jack you up, basically. Right. So Six goes on and he encounters the funeral procession for his friend Cobb. And they got like a jaunty little band, jaunty little band playing the music. And
village funerals are weirdly
cheerful.
Yeah.
It's not like that outfit in Live and Let Die.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. International Spy Funerals Band Local 236. So while watching the procession, there's the headstones on a beach. Cobb's being buried, and while he's doing this, he encounters a mysterious, beautiful woman who is weeping at the funeral.
Yeah, she was following behind the funeral, and she's watching from basically this, you know, some sort of, I guess, outcropping overlooking the cemetery, which is on the beach.
And Six talks to her. Can they trust each other? She asks if she can trust him. He asks, "Can I trust you?" And they decide that they're going to meet at a concert at noon. So they do. They meet at a concert at noon, and they have a conversation that we are led to believe is maybe being obscured by the sounds of the band. And they're trying to figure out. She says that she was trying to figure out how to escape with Cobb. And he's like, yeah, whatever. And she says, no, you need like an electro pass to steal the helicopter. And this is like the spy stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Now we're kind of actually getting into the meat of a spy show. It's you're meeting a contact. Can you trust her? Here's the gadget. You have to get out.
Right. And the question is, you know, how did you get the electro pass? I knew the pilots. I think the implication is in the biblical sense there.
Yes.
Yeah. Later on, the mysterious woman meets number two for tea.
And she's given her next assignment.
Yeah. She meets number two for tea, and she's given her next assignment, which is, surprise, surprise, a big picture of number six.
Yeah, apparently Cobb was her previous assignment, but it's no stain on her reputation that he killed himself.
Exactly. So, and that's important. Mm-hmm. As far as she knows, Cobb killed himself.
Right.
As far as she knows. Mm-hmm. So, and then we see Six. He's playing chess with the Admiral. He's on the beach. Mm-hmm. And then he meets the woman. And then there's a boat on the, there's a, the wreck of a boat on the beach. I assume it's the Minnow. I don't know. There's a wreck of the boat on the beach. And then he's angry. He's upset. Like, I trust you? What's going on? What's true? What's not?
They call it the stone boat. There's people playing on it. I think it's supposed to be like just sort of a permanently moored boat for people to just, you know. Yeah,
play boat stuff on.
Because that would be hilarious if the Minnow had actually crashed on the
village. Yeah, because when they first meet the Admiral and the old folks, there are people just jauntily climbing up and down the rigging on the stone boat for no reason that we can tell. That's their recreation, apparently.
It's fun. Do they need a reason?
I guess not.
Well, no, at this point into this, we're assuming those people were basically, you know, instructed to do that or else. Mm-hmm. Well, or else what?
Or else.
Yeah. So, at a certain point,
because you have no idea who here is just going about their life, who here is exactly in number six's situation, who here already works for them, who is all three.
Who's a prisoner, who's a puppet, who's the puppet master, we don't know. So Six meets the woman in the boat and it's an angry confrontation, but she sticks to her story and she passes him a watch that's actually the electro pass he needs to use the helicopter, right?
Right.
Helicopter lands. Six approaches the helicopter.
And she says she was never planning on leaving without Cobb, so she lets him do it himself.
So she's letting him do it himself.
Right.
So Six goes to the helicopter. It's guarded by a rover, but the pass lets him pass. Mm-hmm. He gets on the helicopter. He takes off. Helicopter rises into the sky while the woman watches. Six flies away. Mm-hmm. But is this the end of the episode? No, ladies and gentlemen, it is not. So basically what happens here is that they're watching him in the control room and they let him get almost away and then they throw a switch. Six loses control of the helicopter.
They take control of the helicopter. They've got these guys on this like high-tech seesaw thing.
Yeah, again,
they're doing something in the control room.
I assume they're monitoring because there's like a little map of the village.
Oh, right.
Like a laid out, and it's Yeah, again, there's lots of going in the background nobody comments on. That's just what they're doing.
Yeah. So, so we see the mysterious woman talk to the Admiral. The Admiral asks her to play chess with him. She says, "I don't play." And he says, "You should learn. We're all pawns here." Mm-hmm. So number two, back in the control room, bids farewell to a very living Cobb, mm-hmm. who turns out has done this whole thing, stabbed his friend in the back in exchange for some sort of new assignment. Mm-hmm. The details of which are left vague. Who's he working on? Who are his new masters? I mean, we don't know.
Yeah, they mention, you know, your the phrase "your new masters" is used, and mm-hmm.
So apparently there is a way to get out of the village,
right? So, and he, you know, tells her, "Well, don't be too hard on her." And number two says, "Well, she'll be well taken care of." And that's what I phrase you're going to say, or something to that effect. Mm-hmm.
So what happens? So the implication here is that yes, you can get out of the village, but to do it, all you got to do is sell out. Mm-hmm. So the helicopter lands. Six skulks away from the helicopter, and then the very familiar end credits image of his face hurtling upwards at the camera and suddenly being trapped behind iron bars. Blam! And then we cut to the end credits.
No, that's and Cobb does say before, you know, he leaves, yeah, he's going to be a tough nut to crack.
He's
going to
be a tough nut to crack. So this is. This is so. Here we are.
That was our setup.
So this is the first. Mm. I almost said the first issue. This is the first episode of The Prisoner. This is one of the great works of television. I don't think there's any way to argue that this is one of the great series. Period. So are we thumbs up all around on this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So Stacey, this is your first time seeing. Really, basically, yep, your first time seeing this. Thumbs up.
Oh yeah, very curious to see what a typical episode is like.
Ray, thumbs up.
How many are there?
There are
17 or 18, something like that.
Okay.
It's not even a full season by contemporary standards.
Right. It's 17 episodes.
And only about 12 of which make any sense. I'm just letting you know.
Because I think one of the things I wondered while we were watching it was, you know, what does the typical run of an episode look like? I like the setup, but I'm just not sure. I couldn't imagine what a normal Prisoner episode is like.
So, and that's okay. So that's the thing. So the thing about the ship, mm-hmm. and is, you know, okay, it has the spy setup. It has Patrick mm-hmm. McGoohan, who
it has the language of the spy ship.
Previously, mm-hmm. Patrick McGoohan had been in a very, very popular show called in the UK, Danger Man. It was Secret Agent Man over in the US.
Secret Agent Man.
Right. That song is from that show.
Which, at some point, we need to do that one. That one's really, really, really good TV.
And I'd like to see some of that just to see him do an actual spy show and then kind of have the prisoners the follow up to that.
So you've got essentially Patrick McGoohan doing obviously some kind of agent or operative. I mean, it has, you look at that opening credits and it has pretty much all of the trappings of you expect basically from a, you know, a spy show, okay? But the thing is, the show's called The Prisoner. It's not about...
It looks like a spy show, so we read it as a spy show, but isn't really a spy show? Mm. I don't know.
I think what it's about is... I mean, so the thing is, okay, mm-hmm. The Prisoner, I mean, it's kind of like The Fugitive, right? I mean, if you mm-hmm. found the one-armed man in episode 3, it'd be a real short show,
right?
Okay. But, so it isn't... I mean, the show isn't really about getting out of the village. It's about his struggle to resist all of the attempts of the village to crack him and get him to conform.
Right.
Now we name check the minnow on Gilligan's Island. Gilligan's mm-hmm. Island, we know if they get off the island, the show's over.
Right.
Right. This is not the same thing. You may think, ostensibly, if he gets out of the village, that's the end of the show, except getting out of the village isn't the point of the show.
Right.
The point of the show is, you can't break me. Mm-hmm. The point that, okay, and now we're getting into my interpretation. This is my interpretation of the show. My interpretation of the show is that society will try to break you. Society will try to file your edges down. Society wants you to give them everything you've got so you can just have your little seat in the old folks' home when you're done. And Six says, no, I'm not going to do that. So that's my interpretation of the show.
Right, and that's the thing. That's
like a metaphor for life and individuality.
Exactly, and that's my interpretation. And y'all's interpretations most likely will vary from that, I assume everyone who listens to us.
But no,
I would say that that's probably a very popular one.
Because the thing is, in terms of escape, I mean, the village is the world, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially, so
the global village.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of escape in terms of, like, in mm-hmm. any sort of coercive system, I mean... Yes, you can basically, you know, the number of places you can escape and flee to are about zilch. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess there's probably a couple of uninhabitable islands in the South Pacific. So you're, you know, so that's a question of escape in the sense of getting the other side of this side or that side of the Iron Curtain isn't for the stuff I think Magoon was looking at,
right,
wasn't really an option because the West
it's has the idea of society in general or the system that you're trying.
Right. And again, this is in the 60s. If you look at today, you know, the ability of governments and entities to track you and figure out and basically just sort of essentially apply pressure to you. There's stuff going on that basically, you know, Magoon would, you know, pretty much would have been appalled at, but also pointed, look at the social credit system in China.
For right.
So is there a certain prescience to the show, or is it just a matter of he's talking about the individual versus the system, whatever the system happens to be, we're talking about.
I think it's prescient to the sense that basically any given system is going to try to eventually, you know, the system is going to try to be coercive and get you to basically play within the rules of the system. And we're okay with that when it's basically, okay, don't kill each other, but when it becomes, well, no, you need to do this, or you need to think this way, or you need to vote this way, or you need to basically buy into the thing that basically everybody else in the system is saying.
And let's just politely say that the three of us have widely varying opinions on all kinds of issues, but none of us have ever been real good at buying into the system.
But the thing about it, though, and this is the thing, you can't entirely isolate what was going on there from the Cold War.
Right, it's back
in the middle of the 60s. But the thing, if you look at authoritarian regimes, if you look at Stalinist Russia, if you look at, you know, Communist China, those places,
you don't actually have to whisper Communist China. We don't get any Chinese money to make this show.
I was trying not to pop the mic. If you look at Communist China, if you look at all these various authoritarian systems, part of what they do, you know, is to convince everybody. I mean, look at Orwell, 84, is convince anybody that thinks this is not such a good idea. That's only them. They're the only ones that think things are a problem. Right. Everybody else is cool. But why is it very important that, you know, supreme maximum leader gets 100% of the vote every time? Because, well, no, nobody dissents. Everybody is happy. Okay. Mm. You know, and that's in systems where they even bother with a token vote. Mm. So, you know, that's the fragility of these systems. On some level, they know that, so no effort is spared in terms of making it, you are absolutely alone. There is nobody else anywhere that basically, you know, and that is the genesis of the president, if you look at it.
Okay, and it's all boiled down into one setting and literally one guy.
One guy, there isn't anybody else he can lean on. Uh-huh. It's basically...
Because anybody who starts to sound sympathetic is probably just working for this week's number two.
Yeah.
Right, so...
I love that even number two gets, like, one chance and then... He just never seen again.
Right, there's one exception. And I guess we said earlier that, okay, you could watch the first episode and the last two. Really, you should watch the first two. Because Chimes of Big Ben, the second episode, you see, you know, Leo McKern plays number two. Make a note, you know, if you just want to say, okay, I want The Prisoner in a Nutshell, first two, last two.
Help, I'm The Prisoner in a Nutshell.
But... You know,
little Austin Powers joke there for you. This is the first time The Prisoner has ever been mentioned in the same breath as Austin Powers. Thank you, everybody.
But, I mean, even still, that whole, you know, again, that itself is a commentary on these sorts of systems, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's the, you know, if you don't deliver results, then there, you can always be replaced. Everybody's replaceable. Mm-hmm.
Also, there's no one face to just hate.
No.
Because even the guy who seems to be the most, like, there is no number one. Or is never identified. There's an endless succession of number twos every time you go in there.
That's the thing. Okay, we're used to spy movies where, okay, if you can take out the big bad guy, then problem is solved. We're used to basically, okay, if we can take care of...
The man in the Nehru jacket petting the cat in the volcano lair.
Right. If you can take out the big bad evil guy, you know, basically, or toss the magic artifact into the volcano, everything's good, you know, 1,000 years of peace. Right. But it doesn't sadly work that way.
Right. You actually have to wake up and survive every single freaking day of this.
I mean, okay, Stalin finally died.
Right.
Well, that the Soviet Union
became... Sadly, Stalinism is still not dead.
Yeah, I mean, the Soviet Union became slightly less hellish, but slightly less hellish was still pretty damn hellish.
It was still pretty hellish.
You know.
And one of the... I've discovered a lot of terrible communities on the internet, but the one that surprised me the most is there are still active Twitter Stalinists.
What?
Like, not just communists. That makes Twitter sense to me. But people who are actually Stalinists.
Yeah, Twitter Stalinists? Okay, that was the very last phrase I thought I would ever hear today was Twitter Stalinist.
Well, no, yeah, look up the phrase tanky if you want to basically be disgusted. Now, the thing is, this shouldn't surprise you. There are people wearing freaking Che Guevara shirts like it's a good thing.
But again, those people are just sort of generically lefty. They don't actually think authoritarianism is awesome, I don't think.
Che Guevara was a murderous asshole. I'm aware of
what he was actually like, yes.
I'm just saying, you don't go wear, you know, you don't see people wearing Pol Pot and Mao shirts. You don't see people wearing That's Hitler fair. And Stalin shirts, other than tankies, I guess. But anyway, that just always
bothers me. Oh, there are probably people who wear Hitler shirts for the hell of it now.
But I, you know, though, yes, and they're yes. assholes.
Yes.
I'm just saying, mass murder, you know, you wear a mass murder on your, you probably, you're an asshole. But
yeah, thing, yeah, you kind of got to.
But that's
yeah.
the thing. Okay, yeah. you know, I mean, Castro died, Cuba's still kind of, you know, mm-hmm. Cuba's still an authoritarian state. You know, Stalin died. It's still, you know, Soviet Union was still an authoritarian state. It wasn't for a bit. It was freewheeling. And now Putin, it's now an authoritarian state with, you know, and they're trying to rehabilitate Stalin. The systems always are going to be there and always try to basically compel compliance and compel, you know, you're the only one that's, you're the only one that stands out, be they big systems or small systems. Okay, what follows we may not want to actually commit. We'll see how it goes. But, I mean, your system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's an entire setup. Basically, you know, where you work is basically
it's a system designed to make you conform.
Yeah, and that's.
Here's the thing. I work in without giving any details here, and I don't want to slam any of the people that I actually work with, or any of the Billings administration, or anything like that. I work. Let's keep it simple. I work in a high school. I work in a high school, and one of the things that becomes, and I, after that, I, before that, I worked in an elementary school, and before that, I was a substitute teacher, and I got good looks at elementary, middle, and high school, and I don't want to shock anybody. I don't want to piss anybody off. I don't want to particularly anger, and actually issues of education are going to come up in an episode later on, but I suppose the thing is that you think schools are designed to educate you and teach you about reading, writing, and arithmetic and foreign languages and art and band, but I would argue I think that our system is designed to make you conform. I think it's designed to sand the rough edges off and to make you look and think and act like everybody else, to make you a fine little cog in the machine. And I don't mean any disrespect to any of the students that I've known or any of the teachers that I've worked with. And if like, I don't know if Patrick or Paula or Michelle listen to this, but if you guys are listening to this, you guys are fantastic. And I think you and people like you who work in this system do the best to actually educate the children. Mm-hmm. Although I have actually come to be of the opinion that this system is designed to make you conform. So, that's what systems do. Systems, I think, are designed to make you conform. Systems are designed to make you think and act and believe just like everybody else around you. And we don't really, yeah, I think the three of us never did real good with systems in general. Am I wrong?
Yeah.
I'm sure we've been stuck in a few of our own as well.
The thing is, nobody likes being told what to do, but then if you agree with people telling you what to, you know, that's it. Nobody likes being told to do something they don't want to do. The catch becomes, the problem becomes, it's very easy to, when your side is telling somebody else to do something, to agree that, well, yes, they need to be told to do that, and they need to be made to conform, because that's just...
When you're one of the many instead of the few or the one to bring in the Spock
scene. The question becomes, at that point, is wondering, should anybody be telling anybody they have to do this, that, or the other thing, or they can't do this, that, or the other thing?
And obviously, just in society in general, even with stuff like school, there is a reasonable argument. There's a certain level of, you know, order that has to be maintained in order to accomplish anything.
Well, my friend Michelle actually had a phrase there, the management realities of middle school.
Right.
Even if you accept that the goal is to try to get people an education, help them learn and think for themselves, there are the management realities of middle school. You have to get in a line to go to the cafeteria as a class to maintain flipping order.
Right.
And again, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, this isn't a show about the prisoner just basically pulling out a machete and hacking left, right, and middle at everybody else there, because a good chunk of the people in the village are probably just innocent cogs caught up in the machine just like everybody else. It isn't a function of...
Or let's bring a little Matrix into this. They're part of the system. They're not ready to be freed.
Well, I think the question becomes is when you are... Are you going after the people left and right because you're just taking a frustration of the system on them? Or are you... We are taking this out on the system. The thing is, there's not a lot of punching and gunplay in The Prisoner.
We're not completely without, but there's not a lot of gunplay. There's an X amount of punching.
There's some punching. But it's not, okay, but it's a lot more of basically how do you, it's a lot more of resisting what they're trying to do.
Right.
Wouldn't you have loved to have seen the Wild Wild West version of the village? Speaking of punching. I'm sorry, you want to roll. I just had that crazy thought. Never mind.
But, so that's the thing. I mean, the question becomes in terms of how do you ethically resist a coercive system without, you know, but in a way where you're not, you know,
effectively lashing out at the other prisoner.
Right. Inflicting injury on the other people in the system. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's, those are some, those are the questions how you grapple with that. How do you resist an unjust system mm-hmm. without being unjust to the other people caught up in that system that are as equally, you know, mm-hmm. stuck in it as you are?
So this is how Ray responds to it. He, how do you ethically resist a coercive system without hurting innocent people? So that's the question he comes away with. I come away with, frankly, I just love Six as a character. I like the character. It's like, I know, would I like to know him personally? Could I sit down and have a cup of tea with Six? Probably not. He'd just do that bug-eyed look at me and like, well, get out of my face. But I respond, Stacey, what do you respond to? What do you take away?
Well, like I said, I'm just kind of starting on this journey, so I just want to see where it all goes and what this guy has to deal with next.
This is a long-term project for us. We're going to be doing this episode by episode. We're not going to do it sequentially. We're going to space out things in between here, but our plan is to go through all 17 episodes of The Prisoner. That's one down, 16 to go. Thank you for coming on this journey with us. I'm Eric. I am your grumpy number six. That's number six, all lowercase, all letters, at agentsof.cool. Ray?
I'm Ray, R-A-Y, at agentsof.cool.
Stacey?
I am Mrs. Peel, M-R-S-P-E-E-L, no period, at agentsof.cool.
Now, this show, I think, is also provocative in a lot of ways. If you've got opinions, send us an email. We may read it on the air. In fact, please do send us your opinions, and we would love to hear a little interaction on this one. And Leighton, Gina, Susan, if you're all listening, please let us know what you think. And thanks again for listening, and we'll be back with you soon.